I want to go back to politics, and again, the matter of denial, the matter of acquiescence, lack of clarity, adversary procedure. Where have the Democrats been all this time? It's still very hard to hear a Democratic voice that begins to get what you get, and what I think an awful lot of those Dean voters get, that we're in deep trouble.
I have to say, it is... I look at the many Democrats who clearly, this is not the kind of country they want to become. And they probably do understand the numbers, at least for their staffs do. And they understand, I think, a lot of people in Washington really understand that. It's amazing how many people, if you are talking to them off the record, will say, start telling you about Wag the Dog. It's amazing how cynical, actually, many people are. But they're always looking at those poll numbers, and they're thinking about the midterm, and they're afraid. They want to be cautious, which I think is actually, at this point, aside from being cowardly, also actually foolish. Because saying, I'm like Bush, only less so, is not, as we've seen, a winning electoral strategy. But they... I have to say I've been shocked. I cannot, I obviously cannot, Times rules, I can't endorse a candidate. In principle, I'm not even choosing parties in the presidential election, so you can see my careful neutrality. But it's amazing to me that no one, the failure of all the frontier candidates except for Dean to pick up on the very justified outrage that a lot of people are not to tap into that, it is amazing to me. I just don't know what these guys are thinking.
Go back to the economics, Paul, the world economics of all this. How long can this country live on, essentially, the foreign investment in the dollar, which is what the empire is running on at the moment?
Well, okay, yes. I mean, we're now back to twin deficits. The federal government's running a roughly $500 billion a year deficit. The U.S. as a whole is running a roughly $500 billion a year deficit. It's all financed by inflows of foreign money. Not at this point, it turns out, mostly. We had big deficits in foreign trade deficits in the Clinton years, but not though we had a budget surplus. In those years, it was financed by foreigners investing in American businesses. Now it's largely foreign governments buying treasury bills. And that only lasts as long as they think it's a safe investment, which is really all about believing that they have to believe that the U.S. is ultimately going to get its house in order. And at some point, of course, we could get our house in order. Physically, technologically, economically, it's utterly feasible. The U.S. has resources to deal with all of this. But politically, I don't think we're going to until we have a very, very nasty shock. Now, when does it end? There's a point at which it has to end, which is when, no matter what people believe, the money will run out. That point is 20 years away. But that's not the way markets work. Markets usually start to see the wall a long time before you hit it. The analogy I often use is Wile E. Coyote. If you ever watch Roadrunner cartoons, Wile E. Coyote always runs off the cliff about 10 paces, then looks down and realizes there's nothing under him. And that's what's going to happen to the United States. We're going to have a Wile E. Coyote moment. I think it comes before the end of this decade. Because if the kind of irresponsibility, unwillingness to face up to the conflict between the promises government is making and the revenue it's taking in persists for several more years, then investors, bond investors, will take a look at the fact that the baby boomers are marching steadily towards age 65 and say, oh boy, it may still be the greatest power on earth, but it's also a banana republic in terms of its internal politics. And at that point, all hell breaks loose.
Speaking of bondholders, it strikes me that we could be approaching something like a Bush perpetual wealth machine for the idle rich. If you build up the government debt and take the taxes off unearned income, the rich will be rich forever. I mean, was there malice aforethought in that pattern of monster deficits and cut the taxes?
There was malice aforethought, but I don't think that's it. I don't think it's for the bond. By the way, the bondholders are very largely actually not domestic wealthy, although they own some. But if you really ask who's holding that debt, and who will I think be left holding the bag when the dollar plunges and the solvency of the U.S. government is called into account. A lot of it is Japanese pension funds and the Reserve Bank of China, which is so it's actually not that story.
But are they in the room tonight?
I'm sure they're looking at it quite carefully. But if you actually ask who is the malice aforethought is the determination to lock in very low taxes on people with high income, and if possible to actually eliminate taxes on investment income, so that we get this sort of pre-Franklin Roosevelt tax structure built in, and then we discover there isn't enough money to pay for Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, and you say, oh, but we can't raise taxes, and the programs are squeezed. And that's not even hypothetical. You can identify the key lobbyists, the key organizations that are pushing for this. I very much doubt that Bush is thinking to himself, my vision of America in 2020 is a nation returned to McKinley levels of social services. I think he just thinks that he wants to win the next election, and he remembers that daddy lost the election because the hard right, he disappointed the hard right, and so he's going to do whatever they say. But I think that the hard right is in fact thinking that way.
How about McKinley levels of taxation?
To get to McKinley levels of taxation, you would also have to have McKinley level of armed forces, which we're not going to have. If you look at, by the time estate tax is fully phased out, the coupon clippers will have their lowest taxes since the Hoover administration. Not quite back to McKinley levels, but we are pretty close already to having it. It's a good time to be rich if you don't sort of worry about what's happening to the country around you.
Paul, I'm one of those people who's still sore with the Democrats for not sharpening these issues in the last campaign, and I'm a little bit sore with you and with my friend Tony Lewis for stiff-arming Ralph Nader's critique of the whole thing out of the campaign. You write in your book, you include a column, an anti-Nader column written in the year 2000. I wonder, should we not all have listened more carefully to Ralph Nader's warnings about the corruption of the whole game?
Okay, three-part answer. Because let me just talk first about my substantive disagreement with Nader. Political strategy aside. Nader is, as far as I can make out, just against globalization across the board. And I'm not willing to buy into that because ultimately, as a human issue, the most important thing in the world is to get a major improvement in the standards of living of people in the poorest of countries. And there have been...
You don't thank you for that?
I think he's for it, but I think he's at the same time, by being against expansion of world trade, by being against having export markets open for these countries, he's against the one thing that has actually made lots of progress. You know, let's not forget that although there are many downsides, the rise of China, it has done more for more people than almost anything else that's happened in today's world. That it's because of those labor-intensive manufacturers and the sweatshops in Bangladesh that however horrible they are by comparison with what we think of as a decent standard of living, that's the only thing that's kept that country from mass starvation, from just sheer Malthusian pressure. So there's a lot of good stuff that comes from an open world trading system that lets people export. Now, that doesn't mean I'm all in favor of all kinds of globalization. I actually stuck my neck way out 5 years ago by coming out in favor of capital controls during the Asian crisis, which was I got a call from the person who was not yet president of Harvard to tell me how wrong I was about that. And, he was wrong and I was right. But the point is, I think that Nader, on the substance of this, is throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That he so much dislikes seeing corporations make profits that he's also rejecting what is, in fact, the one best hope we have for an upward path in the standard of living of the world's poorest. Now,
listen, let me just say, and it's not for me to represent Ralph Nader, but he'd give you a very strong argument on that point. My question is, would we not all have been radically better off to have that incisive, unbelievably informed, experienced, trusted voice hammering it out and flushing out George Bush's issues
yes,
3 years ago.
The question was, he was on, credit where credit is due, Nader understood better than I did the depth of the corruption that was taking place in government and in capitalism. What I didn't understand was how... So we had basically competent, reasonable government in the Clinton years, but what I didn't understand was that the forces of greed and corruption were very strong and wouldn't be satisfied with that. And of course, I didn't understand about the level of corruption that was taking place within corporations. And so I'm not sure that Nader fully understood that either, but he was certainly... His rottenness detectors were better than mine. Now, the question is, what would anything have satisfied Nader in the campaign? Because what was clear to me...
I think he'd have been happy with a landslide victory.
For himself. But the point was that wasn't going to happen. And what I think I had a strong sense of, even during the 2000 campaign, was that office is a very powerful thing. Didn't realize how much they'd be in a position to exploit 9/11 to really extend their power. But office is a very powerful thing. And the theory that says, well, we need to lead the Democrats down to defeat because that will force them to really face up to the issues. Maybe that's true in the very long run, but as one of my heroes, John Maynard Keynes, said, in the long run, we are all dead. And the fact was that Nader helped deliver the country into the hands of people who can do an enormous amount of damage from holding that up. Let me just say, I'm willing to grant him a lot of credit, but if he runs again, nothing is forgiven.
To go back in history a moment, you include a column here very supportive of the World Trade Organization, very anti the Seattle rabble. We've got now the Cancun rabble and a lot of altitude loss. Well, of course it was different, but I want the Krugman take on the World Trade Organization 3 years later.
Okay. Actually, the World Trade Organization is, first of all, it's what it is greatly exaggerated. It's just a slight further formalization of the bureaucracy for trying to keep countries honest in the promises they make in trade negotiations. It's not a world government. The people involved are, as these things go, relatively decent. It's not simply a tool of the corporations in the U.S. It's the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade given a better secretariat. Which is a good thing because that kind of forum actually gives more role to the small countries, the countries that don't have a lot of weight. Now, Cancun.
Explain that breakdown.
Okay, if you're just doing one-on-one trade negotiations, if Uruguay negotiates with the United States, you just know that the weight is all with the United States. To create a formal organization where there are votes, where there's a secretariat in Geneva that enforces the rules, it's much more likely to say, U.S., you are in violation, which the WTO has now done several times, which is a good thing. Now, one of the things that's supposed to happen is we're supposed to have trade negotiations in which the big powers, in fact, give as well as take. And in Cancun, they made it clear that they weren't willing to. And the 21 nations walked out entirely correctly. So this was a good way for negotiations to break down. It was a breakdown over the countries whom the WTO is supposed to represent saying, if it isn't the real thing, then it shouldn't happen. And I think that was very good for the long run. By the way, I have to say that all of this stuff strikes me as, you know, I'm so terrified about what's happening domestically that trade negotiations seem definitely second order. Some people may, I'm now the most dangerous liberal, et cetera, et cetera. 7 years ago, Bob Kuttner had a cover story in the American Prospect, attacking me for free trade advocacy and all that. But my dream of the future, and I suspect Bob's as well, is that we can get back to an America where he and I can afford to be enemies again.
I'd like to...
It all seems insignificant. Those differences seem insignificant compared with what we're facing now.
I know people want to hear the Krugman program. Take the four legs that you talked about. Imperial militarism, repression... Religious extremism, tax cuts until we're dead. What's the program to get us out of there, Paul?
Okay, the religious and I don't know what to do about that. To be honest, I don't know.
Pray, I think.
Pray is probably the answer. I had my moment of shock when I realized that the giant Barnes & Noble on Route 1 in Princeton, which is, you know, for God's sake, for whom it may concern's sake, with central New Jersey, which is a very blue part of a very blue state, nonetheless has a large section of religious fiction, which is all the Tim LaHaye Left Behind stuff. So this is very powerful in the U.S., and I don't quite know how we cope with that, except to say there's always a strain in the U.S., and normally it's kept under control. It's the unholy or maybe holy alliance of those people with others that makes them so powerful now. And the militarism, I think that's, so far, it appears to be imploding this was supposed to be an easy warm-up. This was supposed to be an hors d'oeuvre before the main course, and to demonstrate just how well foreign wars go, and it's not exactly playing out. But the rest, okay, I think it's tremendous effort needs to be made to reconnect people with to understand that their taxes pay for something, and that the welfare state is not just about the poor, that the fact is that middle-class people are much more likely to find themselves in need of those programs than they are to find themselves part of the handful of people who benefit from these tax cuts. And in terms of political organizing, I have no idea what works, except that you just have to keep fighting.
Have you got an answer to the Patriot Act?
I hope this will go away. I mean, I hope there will be a great... I talk about a great revulsion in the government. Certainly, I hope on that. It's scary stuff. I mean, I tried... You know, no serious journalist, no allegedly serious journalist was as nearly right as The Onion, on January 18th, 2001, they had a mock speech by George Bush in which he said, "Our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity is finally over." I had a feeling in my gut that these people might have authoritarian instincts, but I never dared write that because I couldn't come up with any evidence. And sure enough, they do, and it's pretty scary.
I wanted to ask you about your method. Let me combine that with a question about what you just said. Do you find, as I do, there's a lot of plain-spoken American wisdom to be had free on the web every day, more than in the press?
There was an extended period during 6 months or more after 9/11 when I was reading the internet because it was the only evidence I had that there were other people out there who were not who shared my delusions, put it that way. So it is important. Part of it, but the biggest single thing, let's be clear, a blog, there are terrific blogs out there, but a blog is not a newspaper. Most of them don't do original reporting. They don't do, they don't have resources. They can't. Most bloggers, as far as I can make it, are just individuals who are concerned. The biggest thing that the web gives you right now is access to international press. The most important thing is that it gives you an ability to see people out, to read The Independent, The Guardian, The Globe and Mail. But then there are people out there definitely doing straightforward, very, very good commentary that is, is being missed.
I want to disagree with you. I mean, I love The Guardian and all the other foreign press, but you can see on the web the instinct to do what you admit the press doesn't do anymore, which is to say, Mr. President, you're bare-ass naked. Your numbers don't add up.
No, I think
that's an important thing. Service of journalism,
I think
too.
It's a great thing. I mean, I think it's a chaos of blogs out there, but there are many very, very good ones. And one of the funny things, by the way, is that there are some influential liberal blogs that people assume must be somebody important, must be a Washington insider. And I have no inside knowledge about any of these, but as far as I can make out, it's actually just some concerned software engineer or something who is reading the papers and putting two and two together and has the nerve to put two and two together because he or she won't be excluded from the right cocktail parties.